Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I'm your host, Donna Fishson. Today, I'm very excited to be talking to Bruce Fink about Volume 1 of his latest book, Against Understanding, Commentary, Cases, and Critique in a Lacanian Key. It's by Routledge, 2013. And in about a month or so, we will meet again to discuss Volume 2, so please look out for that. So I'm going to briefly introduce him. As many of you in the audience probably know, Bruce Fink is a practicing Lacanian psychoanalyst and analytic supervisor. He trained in France for 7 years and is now a member of the École de la Cause Freudienne in Paris. Please don't throw tomatoes at my French. The Institute Lacan created shortly before his death. Bruce obtained his PhD from the Department of Psychoanalysis at the University of Paris. 8, Saint-Denis. He served as professor of psychology from 1993 to 2013 at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, and is currently an affiliated member of the Pittsburgh Psychoanalytic Center. Bruce is the author of 6 other books on Lacan, translated in many, many different languages. Some of my favorites, The Lacanian Subject, Between Language and Jouissance, by Princeton in 1995, it was published. A Clinical Introduction to Lacanian Psychoanalysis, Theory and Technique, Harvard University Press, 97. Lacan to the Letter, Reading a Cree Closely, Minnesota Press, 2004. And Fundamentals of Psychoanalytic Technique, A Lacanian Approach for Practitioners, which was published by Norton in 2007. He's translated also several works of Lacan, Lacan's works, including A Cree, the first complete edition in English from 2006, for which he received the 2007 Nonfiction Translation Prize from the French-American Foundation and the Florence Gould Foundation. Seminar 20, Encore, on Feminine Sexuality, The Limits of Love and Knowledge, among others, on the name of the Father, Names of the Father, The Triumph of Religion. And Seminar 8, Transference, is forthcoming, or maybe it's already, I think it's still forthcoming from Paul.
It's still forthcoming, right?
Okay. Okay. And he's also the co-editor of 3 collections on Lacan's work, published by SUNY Press, Reading Seminar 11, Reading Seminars 1 and 2, and Reading Seminar 20. So, in sum, Bruce Fink is the authority on Lacan in the English-speaking world. And though we've never spoken before, he's my subject supposed to know. So, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anna. It's nice to be here.
So when people ask me how I became interested in Lacan, I tell them about one night in December 2003. I was sick with a bad cold, and I was actually in the midst of dissertation write-up, so therefore wretched. And I was lying in bed staring resentfully at a pile of books I was storing for a friend in my tiny New York apartment. And on top of this pile was your Clinical Intro to Lacanian Psychoanalysis. And I started reading it, and I couldn't put it down. And then I immediately read Lacanian Subject, and then I read Lacan to the Letter. And then a few books by Zizek, and then I began reading Lacan himself, so translated by you and other people. So that's my story, okay? That's it. I'm not going to talk about myself here. So, okay,
that's
my
story.
So what's yours, Bruce? I'm curious. What first inspired you to study Lacan, and why did you get? Why do you think you became so hooked?
There are a couple of separate questions there, but I think I first encountered Lacan's work as he was being lambasted by Deleuze and Guattari in Anti-Oedipus. And since they, took him to task so thoroughly, I had to see who they were taking to task. But of course, it was impenetrable to read him, directly at that time in English, and I didn't speak French at all. And I was lucky enough to be living in Ithaca, New York, and a guy named Richard Klein was giving a course on Lacan and Derrida and Foucault, and so Richard gave me my first introduction to Lacan, and I got hooked on the idea of the subject of the unconscious, and I think I also got hooked on the fact that he seemed to be talking about things that intrigued me, but I didn't know what he was saying. And I think that kept me going for a very long time. I think I got to a stage, I guess, at that point, after having been through a lot of really difficult philosophy and political philosophy, where the harder it was, the more I liked it for some masochistic reason, I guess. But, of course, the fact that he was talking about love and he was talking about subjectivity and the unconscious, all of those were very important to me, and that certainly got me started and has kept me going for a very long time. I still find a lot of things he says very perplexing, and but it always spurs me on to reflect, even if I'm not sure I agree with him or I think maybe he's frankly wrong. I always find it so much more rewarding to read his work than many other authors. So, That's my story.
I was very quick there. I wanted to confess that. Okay, so in your book, there are several interviews where you answer this question, right? And you say at one point, and you said it. You said it in the course of your answering it here, but that you were drawn to Lacan's notion of the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And this really resonated with me as well, his notion of the subject. And so I guess I was hoping you'd elaborate a little bit on that. What was it about his notion of the subject that, you know?
Yeah, I think that would be hard to say right now, initially what grabbed me, but, you know, I was, coming out of, studies of philosophy and even religion, Eastern religions, where the question of, you know, what is the self, what is identity, and, you know, some Freud as well, the ego, superego, and id. Well, you know, what the hell is this thing that we refer to as ourselves? And like many people in the 70s, I was certainly hearing about Zen and in Hindu, I studied some Hinduism when I was at Cornell and Buddhism, and the question of, well, you know, what exactly is this thing that we call ourselves seemed quite mysterious and opaque, and Freud seemed to have an answer that had something to do with the unconscious, and then Lacan had this mysterious phrase, the subject of the unconscious. So I think, and yet it was obvious that there wasn't a kind of permanence to it, but it didn't mean, it seemed to me at least in Lacan's work, that that meant there was nothing to it whatsoever, and it wasn't somehow absolutely crucial. So it wasn't a sort of notion of perspectivism or a notion of identity in terms of, you know, who I like think of myself as like, and so on and so forth. It seemed to be something more profound to that. And so I think that was what initially intrigued me. That's a historical answer, I guess.
No, I'm very sympathetic to that. And, you know, I was curious about your role as, you had me hooked on page one in your intro to Lacanian psychoanalysis, but I wanted to know what you think about the resistance. Well, maybe you don't think there's a resistance to Lacan in the Anglo-American context, but...
I certainly do.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you agree.
Yeah.
I'd like you to speak to that, I guess. And also conversely, maybe, what do you think is the reason for his popularity in say, Argentina, to the point where, you know, there his concepts are part of common parlance and pop culture?
As I understand it, in Argentina, Klein is also incredibly well known there, and psychoanalysis in general seems to be very well known there. And I would say that at some level, psychoanalysis is has had a harder time in the U.S. than in many parts of Latin America. And so it's not just Lacan. I think Lacan is rejected as impenetrable by many American and English-speaking clinicians in general, more so perhaps than a lot of other, perhaps equally opaque psychoanalysts like Klein and Bion and so on. But I think there's... first of all, there's the historical ever-present rivalry between England and France, such that anything that's French should be rejected by somebody, you know, any self-respecting English-speaking person. Yeah, that's perhaps truer, of course, in England than it is in the U.S. There's obviously an adoration of things French by a certain segment of the American population, and that's more the intelligentsia and the academic community. And I think that the clinicians are very much not part of that for the most part, and some of them are, but many of them consider themselves, and this is probably due to the way psychoanalysis developed in the United States through medical channels primarily. Many American analysts view themselves more as like doctors, like physicians, as, you know, clinicians, practitioners above all, and not... they're professionals and not necessarily well-versed in the humanities, and they don't necessarily think of themselves as intellectuals per se.
Mm-hmm.
So there certainly is resistance, and I think, there's a historical piece as well, which is that... Lacan's a very difficult writer. The first translations were, you know, very tough to get through, and Lacan didn't make it any easier when he came and spoke in the States. And even as a person, I don't think he did much to try to make himself likable in America anyway. I don't know exactly in England if he made many dents there, but likableness can go a long way, I think, even when your work is very difficult. And
It's interesting. Well, we'll come back to the issue, I think, of translation. But I wanted to start to talk about the book more directly, and the title and the eponymous first chapter, of course, Against Understanding. So that's provocative. And so why is understanding or meaning-making also, and meaning-making, not the point of treatment, in your view?
Because I think that what happens when the emphasis is placed on understanding and meaning-making, then change gets lost in the sauce, so to speak, that the priority to make something fundamentally new happen, to really radically transform a person, gets left by the wayside, in a sense, where it the focus on understanding becomes a distraction in a way that the clinician becomes so concerned with, have I understood my patient correctly, and can I convey this understanding transparently somehow, or without any loss of material of comprehension to the patient, that there's a loss then of the notion of, well, what is this understanding supposed to do? What does understanding for a patient, what does it do for the patient? And first of all, a little context there. You know, I spent 20 years teaching in a department that emphasized understanding. And so I worked with students who were being taught that it was all about meaning and all about understanding. And the question that I would always raise to them in my classes, well, you know, what good has it done you to supposedly understand your patient's problem and to explain it to them? And what good has it done your patient to supposedly know that a particular problem arose exactly at this moment in time, and perhaps for this particular reason, was that curative? And, you know, my sense is that most of the time, no, it wasn't. And, of course, I also, the other context to it is that perhaps like many other analysts as well, I always talk about myself as a mental health provider of last resort, that, you know, Lacanian psychoanalysis is such a weird thing to do, that usually people have done 3 or 4 different other kinds of therapy or analysis before they come to me, and they often have a whole story about what they've understood about themselves and about their lives. Mm-hmm. And you know, their complaint is often, you know, well, I know all of that, you know, perfectly well, but, you know, I'm still doing the same things that I was always doing. So that, again, seems to, we could say, well, they had the wrong understanding of things, or we could just say that understanding somehow is not really the key to making something new happen for someone.
Mm-hmm. So what is the key? Is it producing a certain type of knowledge?
No,
could you
again,
draw a distinction between knowledge and understanding.
I mean, we could at a certain level, because we could talk about unconscious knowledge, and Lacan certainly talks about that at times. But the notion there is that it's a knowledge that's contained in the unconscious, which has not been formulated and therefore in conventional terms in any case not understood. So we can imagine a knowledge that exists in someone without there being any understanding of it. What I would suggest is that we're trying to produce a change in the unconscious and even in the knowledge, let's say somehow written in the unconscious, we're trying to change that as opposed to someone's conscious understanding of things. And the hope then is that a change in the unconscious leads to a change in one's capacity for jouissance, that what you enjoy, the ways you're able to enjoy and what you enjoy changes in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So a bit abstract, but
no, not at all.
Can
you relate your point about understanding not really causing change to your, I was thinking about your 2007 book on technique, and there you make this case against empathy, a pretty strong one, and then and also projective identification as a sort of central concepts of treatment and technique. So all these things I feel like are related, they're of a piece. I was wondering if, I mean, you don't have to, this is asking a lot perhaps, but maybe we can, maybe you can talk a little bit more about understanding as it relates to other forms of sort of tools, if you will, that the analyst has, like empathy and different concepts like projective. I'm not sure projective identification totally fits this, but I feel like it's related for you, or you can relate them perhaps.
Yeah, I think empathy is the easiest one to relate because I think conventionally, at least, empathy is often thought of as a way of saying, you know, I understand what you're going through, and often the subclause there is because I've been through something similar myself. And that's, you know, so, right, that's the sort of presumption that the therapist seems to make when empathizing with someone. Oh, that must have been difficult for you. That kind of statement is usually made when the therapist believes that if he or she had been through the same experience as the patient, he or she would have found it painful. Mm-hmm. And so it's supposedly putting ourselves in somebody else's shoes, but actually what it is a projection of, you know, I would have felt this way, therefore you must be feeling this way. And some people would say, well, of course it goes further than that, that we can imagine, even if we haven't had such an experience, we can imagine why it would be painful for some other person. I find that in most cases, when therapists say things like that, it's often not true that it was exactly painful for the patient. And the patient often says, you know, what the hell do you know about it? You know, you've never been through this. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get those kind of embarrassing questions when the patient says to you, well, have you ever been? And then they describe a situation which probably only three people on earth have ever been in before, and you have to say, well, no, not exactly. Well, then how could you know what I'm talking about? Again, there is a kind of imaginary component to both of those, I think, of understanding and empathy, because there's a presumption on the therapist's part that, let's say, she understands what the other person is going through based on her own experience, whereas the patient often experiences that as not at all true, and that it's a fantasy on the patient, on the therapist's part, that the therapist really knows what the patient is going through. And the patient often finds evidence for that in the kind of comments that the therapist makes about that experience, of feeling that the therapist is really barking up the wrong tree. Now, you don't get it at all. You know, you really don't know what I'm talking about. So I think those are related, and perhaps I think projective identification would, I think we would be a bit more complicated to link up there, but certainly projection itself is very closely linked to the notion of empathy and a presumption that we do understand what somebody else is going through. Mm-hmm. And I often hear that from therapists that I supervise, of course. They say, well, I could tell by the expression on his face that, you know, X, Y, and Z. And I say, well, I don't know. From what you've told me, I'm not so sure that that's exactly what was going on, right?
I see what you mean, yeah. Actually, I mean, what you seem to be arguing against, too, here is a kind of presumption on the part of the analyst that the analyst really knows, right? The mm-hmm. analyst is supposed to occupy the position of a subject supposed to know, perhaps, but certainly not believe that or act as if he or she really knows. So right. I guess, though, you know, I feel like there's always a tension in technique papers, though. I mean, even as you try to argue for oracularity, is that a word, or polyvalence, mm-hmm. etc. I just think it's difficult to write a technique paper or write up a case or I don't know, a clinical vignette without displaying mastery. It seems that a certain mastery or coherence is sort of inherent in that genre or maybe narrative form generally, you know. So I guess my question is, like, how do you guard against that or can you?
Right. Well, I tried to address that. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the preface to the second volume. But I talk about that a lot because, you know, I taught a class called Case Formulation for many years. And first of all, I always encourage the students to talk about the cases where they felt they screwed up the most, where they were absolutely useless as therapists, or they think they made huge mistakes. Because obviously, when people do give public presentations, what they try to do most of the time is to show that they're competent, if not brilliant, therapists. And so I indicate in that preface that, you know, it is in writing up clinical papers that analysts are most inclined to lie through their teeth. And, you know, I'm not saying I'm completely excluded from that. I think that all of us, when we make a clinical presentation, there is a strong temptation to make it sound like we know what we're doing and that we know where we're headed and that, you know, we've sort of got things more or less under control. Maybe, you know, we made a mistake here or there, but that generally speaking, you know, we're sort of doing the right thing. And so what I point out in the preface and what I always talked about in the class was the number of completely invented facts, invented scenarios, and even invented analyses, lock, stock, and barrel, that we find in the analytic literature, not the least of which is Heinz Kohut's two analyses of Mr. K, I think it's called, where he invented one of the analyses in the book Lock, Stock, and Barrel. And so I think you're quite right that, first of all, many people misunderstand Lacan's notion of the subject supposed to know to mean that the analyst really does know.
Right.
And that's a problem right off the bat. And I think many analysts, especially in a kind of context of professionalization of psychoanalysis, believe that they do know. And when the longer they're at it, they think, well, yeah, you know, I do know more and more. And especially people who talk about intuition a lot, and they think that, you know, the longer they've been practicing, they have this fabulous intuition now. Again, I think, you know, there is this bad tendency to think, you know, I really do know what's going on for this person, and the longer I practice, the more quickly I catch on and so forth. And I think that really fundamentally goes against everything Freud and Lacan argued, which is that, you know, every case is unique, and it's a struggle for us to fathom what's going on in any case. And the moment that we begin to think that there are somehow rules and regularities, we're really, you know, pulling the wool over our own eyes. I attempt a little bit in there are about 9 different cases that I've included in volumes 1 and 2, and I try to at least, you know, especially probably in the rewriting of them for this collection, to indicate just how unsure of what's going on I am at different points in time. And, you know, depending on the venue in which I gave the paper, I probably succeeded or didn't succeed so well at that. But my hope is at least that I don't give anyone the impression that I think I really do know what exactly was going on all the time, and that I thought I was doing the right thing, and that I knew more about it than the patient did, and so on and so forth.
You know, it occurs to me that, so Lacan didn't write up his cases, right? He never, did he use any of his own clinical material?
He did, but not a lot. Precious little. Yeah, there are a couple of vignettes in his work. There are various reasons for that. Some of them perhaps not as good as others. Lacan was, of course, he did write up a lot of his work with a patient in his doctoral thesis, but he wasn't an analyst yet. So he was a psychiatrist at the time. So you have a dissertation that was based on, you know, probably about 200 pages of material related to a single patient. But later in his work, a lot of his teaching was to a whole group of people who were his patients or his supervisees. And it was, I think, in many cases, very tricky for him to ever mention a patient without other people in the audience recognizing who he was talking about. And so, you know, the problem of confidentiality was obviously quite important there. But there also was not, and there still, even today, is not that big a French tradition of writing up case histories in the way Freud did, or in the way we're more used to, I think, in America. When I read quite a few of the French case histories, they're often 5 pages, and they're written in such vague terms that there's more theory than there is, you know, clinical material, to my mind. So you basically have to take it for granted that the clinician knows what she's talking about, and I often come away thinking, you know, well, what did I learn from that? You know, is there something applicable to my own practice from that?
So you disagree with Lacan? I mean, do you think it's very important to write up one's cases then? And why do you do it? What is the purpose of that for you?
Well, there are a number of purposes for me. There are pedagogical purposes, but also for myself, despite numerous years of my own supervision with people I worked with in France, I continue to find it very useful to present a case that I'm having trouble with to a group of my colleagues at a conference, usually something on the small side, not, you know, hundreds of people, but a small group. Many of whom I know, and we've worked together for many years, and so right, that they give me feedback. They can, you know, since they're not there in the room with the patient, they can propose things that are completely different from what I was thinking. And even if I don't ultimately accept it, it forces me to think further. So it gives me a different take on the case. It's a kind of group supervision in that sense. And so some of the some cases I wrote up for more pedagogical purposes to, you know, train other clinicians, also to illustrate certain concepts. So, for example, in Volume 1, there's a case of fetishism, and, you know, writing up that case and thinking about it over the years led me to think of fetishism as involving a logic, which I call a both-and logic, which is somewhat different from the logic that we find, say, in neurosis or psychosis. And so writing up cases, to me, is they may illustrate the theory, but they may also allow us to come up with something new at a theoretical level. That's my hope would be, at least. And I think also that for people who are learning about the theory and the practice, they don't really know what the hell it looks like, what the practice looks like, unless you give them some examples of it. And of course, they're only the examples of how I practice, and every Lacanian that I know practices very differently, and they all practice quite differently from me in certain respects. So all I can do is give an example of what I do. But if you want to give people a sense, it's a way. To write up a case, I think, is to put yourself to the test in some sense, right? Is to show, well, what is it that you really do when you practice? Because there are plenty of people who talk a good theoretical line. And then, you know, when you hear, you send a patient to them, you refer someone to them, a relative, a friend of a friend, or whatever, and you hear about what went on exactly. You go, oh, my God, I can't believe it. I'll never send somebody to that person again. And so it's nice to have a sense of, you know, was this person able to work successfully for a number of years with somebody? What seemed to be the outcome? Even if it's an ongoing case, you know, does there seem to be improvement?
Oh, so, you know, you mentioned this, the boot fetish case. Right. And I was actually, it was really interesting to me because you, in that, there's a whole chapter, there are several chapters on that Analizan, correct? Or is that?
No, that was one.
Okay,
right.
I conflated two of them. Okay.
Right, yes.
So, but you follow the boot one, in your chapter. You all the paths of his association, you trace all the signifiers and sort of fantasies that lead and connect. to his being haunted by these big black boots, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you discuss the boot as the name of the father and the object, an object that performs a kind of a limit-setting function, et cetera. So, but I want to ask you because, okay, so this is more for my own personal interest. So there was this moment in the 90s, the 1990s, when I was in graduate school, I guess, but I've taught this literature in my own classes anyway, when lots of, the moment was when lots of sociologists and cultural theorists, it seemed, were very interested in writing about fetishism. Sexual fetishism, commodity fetishism. And the question of female fetishism, sexual fetishism, came up repeatedly. And I thought it was strange that some people were very committed to discovering that they were female fetishists, or sort of arguing for this possibility of female fetishism. And I guess you know, because I think it was because I figured out it was because some people believed in the creativity of fetishism, that somehow fetishists were sexually creative beings. So, and of course, others insisted that this was a structural impossibility if you follow Freud strictly. So I guess, okay, so my question is, what do you think? I mean, is a feminine sexual fetishist or female identified fetishist possible structurally? Or have you seen it? And, you know, how would you explain it?
Right. Well, I haven't seen it, but I wouldn't rule anything out because I think that would be stupid. I think that, you know, theory has got to always be open to revision. And for me, what was funniest was, I think it was probably, you know, like a week after I published my clinical introduction in 1997, I received in the mail. An advertisement for a new movie that had just come out, and I think it was called Female Perversions.
Uh-huh.
And I had just argued, you know, I had just made this whole theoretical argument in Chapter 9 on perversions that, you know, it's in psychoanalysis, it's considered to be, you know, structurally speaking, you know, for men only, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Women need not apply. And I don't know, you know, I haven't looked into the cases where of supposed female fetishism, but, you know, I'm not saying that, well, I guess what I would say is that our knowledge in psychoanalysis of perversion in general and fetishism in particular is quite limited. That's my sense. It, much, much more limited than, let's say, obsession or hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, first of all, the vast majority of fetishists don't come to see analysts, or when they do, they don't really necessarily engage in a long-term analysis. And I've read precious few cases, you know, written by clinicians of such cases. The people who seem to have more experience with that are people who work in sex offender clinics and so on. And again, the goals of the therapy there are not really to understand the origin of the fetish, but, you know, how to keep it under control. And that isn't necessarily very conducive either to understanding, you know, how and why.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think Lacan necessarily bought entirely Freud's argument on the origin of fetishism. I don't know that he, you know, provided a full-blown theory of it himself. I'm not sure really anybody has a terribly convincing theory of it, but so you know, what I'd love to see is the literature around female fetishism, and not just as, you know, something that's creative or... One thing we could say, let's say from a Lacanian standpoint, is according to Lacan, you know, all sexuality, all human sexuality is fetishistic, and insofar as it involves object A, object A is itself inherently fetishistic. You know, from the moment Lacan invents the notion of object A, it already comes from the time when Alcibiades basically has a fetish related to Socrates, and sees something fetishistic in a sense in Socrates, and which is, of course, the book that I have that will be coming out next year. It's a commentary on love and on Lacan's reading of Plato's Symposium in Seminar 8, where he essentially invents the concept of object A. But that's an easy, you know, theoretical flourish. Say, well, you know, in any case, all sexuality is fetishistic, so why not for women too? But, you know, the specificity of a fetish, I don't know, I wouldn't be able to say.
Right. I mean, I think one paper in one collection called Fetishism as Cultural Discourse argued that actually kleptomania was a form of fetishism. But anyway, it's just different. If we have to change the concept of fetishism, I guess,
right,
to accommodate these other forms, right?
So,
but let's leave fetishism for let's move on to like good old neurosis and psychosis. This is what, so in your second chapter, actually, in the clinical practice section, you discuss the different ways that you treat neurotic and psychotic patients, and so you talk at length about diagnosis according, of course, to Lacan's criteria of diagnosis. And but I was hoping you'd get more on the technique around with psychotic patients. I know you do this in greater depth in the 2007 book, but maybe you can talk a little bit about how, well, first of all, one detects a psychotic structure, and how Lacan defines it, and then maybe say a few things about treatment of psychotics.
Right.
It
is a huge question, and of course, because there are numerous forms of psychosis, and I think a certain number of clinicians at any rate are adept at identifying somebody who is in the middle of a psychotic break and is having obvious hallucinations and so on. And so in certain of those cases, diagnosis is not really a problem for them to, it's not a problem for them to identify who is psychotic and who isn't. However, there has been a tendency in practice and in the literature as well to sort of think, well, you know, people can become psychotic and then they go back to being something else and then they become psychotic again at certain times. And so there's a kind of fudging on a kind of structural difference between the two. Whereas for Lacan, you know, you're psychotic. If you're psychotic, you're structurally speaking psychotic your whole life. That doesn't mean you're in the middle of a psychotic break at every moment, thank God. So I find it especially difficult, even with people who have, you know, read everything that I've written about the distinction between neurosis and psychosis. Practitioners often that I work with, that I supervise or talk with, still have a difficulty seeing the difference between the two. And I think it has something to do with the way people have come to practice these days, whereas Freud and people in the first couple of generations, I think, of analysts, were very attuned to slips of the tongue and double entendres and plays on words. That's all been given up. or largely been given up, and that really the emphasis has been on understanding. Again, when you listen to slips of the tongue, they don't make any sense, right? If you don't listen to them and you immediately substitute in your mind what the person was probably, you think, trying to say, you're trying to understand them and get at the meaning that they're trying, the conscious meaning they're trying to convey. Right, what they've actually said goes out the window, and most clinicians that I work with cannot tell me often, you know, in the first few times we talk about a patient they've been working with sometime for years, whether or not the patient makes slips of the tongue. And, you know, one very common thing that we find in work with psychotics is they make almost none or, you know, or virtually no slips of the tongue. I've already made at least three here. I didn't comment on them because it was too embarrassing. But
Oh my God.
Well, what does this mean? Okay. So that's okay. Sometimes I just start them and then I sort of stop them in the middle so I don't quite get all the way into them. But you know, most people, you know, will make slips of the tongue. And most people, you know, if you work with a neurotic for any period of time, you will hear slips of the tongue if you're at all attuned to them. And that is one of our first, what, you know, Lacan called them unconscious formations, but, you know, Freud referred to them as the parapraxies, and the parapraxies are all about neurosis, right? You know, these parapraxies, you know, when you take out your key to your office, when you come home to your lover, you know, most people, most neurotics can be made to think, I wonder what that means, you know, would I rather be going to my office, or is coming home like going to my office, or, you know, whatever, some confusion between love life and work life. In psychosis, that that reflection, even if such a mistake was made, it remains at the level of a mistake and can't be brought into discourse in a way which might open up a whole set of questions about, you know, what's going on for me at work, what's going on for me at home, is there, right, some kind of weird overlap or problem there. So my sense is that clinicians are no longer attuned to the very simple indications of who is neurotic and who isn't, because they no longer listen for the letter of what somebody says, and so they don't even hear slips of the tongue. They don't even hear their own, because one, they haven't been pointed out in the course of their own psychoanalysis, right, that they did as part of their own training, and they don't do it on a regular basis with their own patients. And what that, the importance of all that is to know whether or not the patient that you're working with has, let's say, an unconscious that functions in the way that we're used to somebody's unconscious functioning. The whole point of that being that when we make interpretations, we're trying to shake up something when we work with a neurotic at the level of the unconscious. And if there is no functioning unconscious in somebody's case, if that person is a psychotic, then we would be foolish to try to shake up something that isn't there to be shaken up. And what we do instead when we make an interpretation that plays on, that involves a play on words of two different meanings of a word that they themselves used, or two different meanings of an expression that they themselves use, they often look at us with perplexity, or they get angry simply that, you know, what the hell are we talking about? You know, yeah, that's what I said. That, you know, you know, a difference in technique in working with psychotics is, first of all, that we're not trying to shake up meaning, whereas with a neurotic we are. We're not trying to shake up a configuration of things in the unconscious with a psychotic as we are with a neurotic. And so the type of interpretations we make, I would even say that for the most part with psychotics, we don't interpret. We make suggestions. We try to encourage certain things that might lead to a change in the way that the psychotic sees a particularly menacing person in their world. We might try to plaster over certain things, calm certain things down. With a neurotic who's talking about a particularly unpleasant person in their life, we probably try to tease out everything about that person, right, and their experience of that person that's unpleasant for them. In the case of a psychotic, once we hear some of the details, we probably want to try to do anything to ensure that their encounter with that person doesn't lead to a psychotic break and help smooth things over. So our position is very different. Whereas we avoid suggestion whenever possible with neurotics, we use suggestion with psychotics. We avoid interpretation with psychotics, whereas we use it sparingly, but nevertheless, hopefully, to good effect with neurotics. So that is a very quick sketch, but...
Yeah, I want to talk to you more about this, but we're running out of time, and I'm just, we haven't even, it's good that we're having another one of these hour interviews, because I want to ask, lots of follow-up questions. But actually, one thing, I wanted to give you, before we end, because I wanted to ask you about translating Lacan, and I also wanted to ask you about body language, because what I actually, I think in your chapter on Lacan's variations on the standard treatment, you talk about how analysts lately privilege the body over speech, and you ask this like seemingly basic question, like why do we assume that the body is somehow more truthful or more primary? So I wanted to give you the opportunity to sort of argue against the importance of body language, but also ask, I mean, is it possible to sort of overcorrect here? Is there a danger of fetishizing speech? Or do you think there's no such possibility, you know?
Well, no, I think that we have to realize that they both lie, that what's important is not to say that speech is more important than body language, but that we can't understand either of them automatically or transparently, and that I think that even many therapists probably think, yeah, well, he's saying that, but that's not really true, or is that really what he means? But when they see a patient cry, they think, oh my God, that's the real stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not true. I mean, I think most of us in our relations with lovers, children, parents, we know that sometimes we cry not simply because we're hurt or we're sad, but that, it's overdetermined and it can be a way of getting somebody's sympathy, if not an outright ploy in a conversation to get somebody to stop yelling at us or to change discourses to, that someone who's being belligerent with us and going on and on about the same thing that they're saying we did wrong, that after a while we just can't, no matter how much we try to justify ourselves, nothing seems to appease them. Well, you break down and cry, and sometimes it stops. It stops the other person. So all I would say is that whereas people tend to say, oh, yeah, the patient's stomach grumbled, and therefore that meant X, Y, X, exactly. And I say, well, how do you know it meant X? Maybe it meant Y. Why don't you ask the patient what she thinks it meant? And so I guess what I would say is not that speech, it doesn't speak the truth. Speech lies just as easily as anything else. But why should we think that body language is a dead giveaway?
Right. Yeah, that it contains something more fundamental somehow to the person.
Right.
So before we conclude for this time, I did want to ask you about translating Lacan. There's a whole section in the book devoted to translation and their interviews. So this will be a kind of maybe meta commentary on those mm-hmm. interviews. And okay, so sure. I guess you're asked by an interviewer in the book. It's something like, you know, given your demands of clarity from for yourself and mm-hmm. your students, like how do you deal with Lacan's impenetrability, basically, or what did the interviewer say? Something about how he makes vagueness into a form of art, or and you were very modest, and you say that, you know, you do what you can to make Lacan as clear as possible and try to understand him and not assume he's just gibberish. He's, when you don't understand something, it's written some gibberish. So anyway, you also talk about how important it is, though, to convey the jouissance of Lacan's text. And so I guess, how do you negotiate that? I mean, do you have to sacrifice clarity for the sake of polyvalence, or is it, I mean, can you have both, or and what do you struggle with there?
I guess it depends somewhat on the text that I'm translating, because some of them are more fun than others. Lacan is having more fun in some of them than in others. In many cases, what I strive to do is to render something in such a way that I think it has the same power in English as it has in French, even if there are one or two other possible resonances in what he's saying that aren't conveyed thereby. And that's when I'll indulge in footnotes to try to explain to readers who want to go a bit further and who maybe know some French what other possible resonances might be there and that I'm leaving out. I find that the better I know French, and you know, I'm still working at it. It's been 35 years, but I'm getting better. And, I spent a lot of the year in France now, and every year my French gets better, and every year I understand things that I didn't understand before. And I find that he's not as vague as I sometimes think, and it's also that.
I see.
It's difficult. The context is extremely important, and things that for us are very vague were not so vague perhaps for people who attended the classes that he was giving, the seminars in particular. Mm-hmm. Cultural references at the time, historical references, current events and so on. People knew what he was talking about and we don't. And a lot of the people he was talking to were reading the same journals, the same psychoanalytic journals, and so they knew when an article by Balint came out and they had all read it too in the International Journal and so on. So I never read that stuff. Mm-hmm. I have to go back and read it, and then sometimes things start. So a lot of things come into focus very slowly. And the more I've translated Lacan, the more I've found that, it isn't nearly as vague as it sometimes seemed, on the first 10 readings.
Also, there are just many references that I have no clue how to even begin. And thanks to your footnotes, though, I do. But, without the footnotes, I don't know.
And there are still plenty of others that, that I've no doubt missed, and that other people, especially people who were working around Lacan were well aware of, and that I'll never be aware of. So, in terms of compromises, I think you always have to make certain compromises, obviously, because of play on words, which seems more or less deliberate in the text. You can't render basically plays on words in another language unless you get really lucky. And so you have to create something, and I'll just take an example from the book, right? I used as an interpretation once with a patient the phrase, "You don't know shit." Right. And so this was a patient who was always afraid that somehow he didn't know his stuff when he got up to teach, or he didn't know what he was saying when he was writing, and who also had all kinds of problems about, going to the bathroom. Mm. And, when I was looking at that today before our interview, I was thinking, how would I translate that into French? And there ain't no way. It is impossible. So, you try to come up with something that might at least convey one of the meanings, and then, all you can do is drop a footnote and say what the other one is, or the other ones potentially are. And it's a series of compromises, of course. And
it's a creative translation is a very creative process. People don't always see it that way, I guess.
I think it is a very creative process, and I find that, for example, in the latest translation that I've done of Seminar 8, that'll be out next year with Polity Press, I gave myself more liberty than I did in the Écrit. The Écrit was so damn difficult, and my French still wasn't as good as it is now, and I think it's easier for me now to find, different ways of saying it and to get out of the French grammar and so on. Anyway, you'll let me know what you think.
Right. I can't wait. Well, listen, Bruce, we've taken up enough of your time. I'm hoping we'll talk again. Maybe we'll be back in about a month to discuss Volume 2.
That would be great. But it's been a pleasure for me.
Oh, thank you so much again for doing this. And thanks to our audience for listening. Until next time.
Thanks to everyone.
Thank you.